Bellfishers by Bizet, with Clarence Raybould conducting. And both were taken from the disc that accompanies the late Alan Blythe's excellent critical study, Hedel Nash, The Recorded Legacy. Well, that's it from me, Rob Cowan, this Sunday morning. I do hope you can join me next week when my central theme concerns water, an inspiration for countless composers. So do join me then, same time, 9 o'clock.
Sunday Morning with Rob Cowan is a unique production for BBC Radio 3, with studio production this morning by Neil Miners.
It's not nice for me to say, but I believe it was racial discrimination.
Is institutional racism still alive in the police?
Progress has been patchy across the country. I know that there's been some progress, but not nearly enough.
The new series of File on 4.
If you were to compare my scenario with a white officer's, you've done something petty, but you can lose your job. They've done something serious, gross, and they keep their job. And, you know, where's the fairness in that?
Over on BBC Radio 4, on Tuesday evening at 8.
Well, this is BBC Radio 3. Just gone 12 o'clock, time for Private Passions with Michael Barclay.
Caroline Duffy was born in the Gorbals in Glasgow. She's the poet laureate, and her writing has won many awards: Standing Female Nude, Selling Manhattan, which won a Somerset Maugham Award, Meantime, the Whitbread Poetry Award, and Rapture, the T.S. Eliot Prize. Her writing reaches all ages and is extremely popular in schools. Her latest collection is The Bees. When you were young, what was the poetry that most inspired you?
Well, I think, like most children, my earliest poems were nursery rhymes, which, of course, would have been told to me by my mother. Not coming from a particularly bookish household, also song. Both my parents sang as they went about the place. I remember parties as a child in Scotland and in England, where I largely grew up, of people standing up and taking a turn singing. So it was more the kind of rhythm of nursery rhyme and early song that perhaps stayed with me. My mother would make up little stories and rhymes herself out of her own head. It might have been that she'd finished all the books that were in the house, so she began to invent. Thereafter, all of my poetry came from wonderful teachers, either in junior school or senior school. So I was exposed quite randomly to a huge range of different poets.
I think one of the reasons that maybe it has struck a chord with school children, what you write, is the fact that it doesn't dodge issues which they're concerned with. It speaks very directly. I think emotion is one of the most important things in your work, don't you?
I suppose I write out of being human. So voice is very important to me, my own voice, but perhaps other voices, voices which perhaps wouldn't be present in poetry. But I'm also mostly engaged with poetic language, with the surprise that the individual poem can offer up to you as you write. I don't set out when I write a poem to, for example, be accessible, be concerned with a particular issue or subject. Each poem is an exciting new venture, an event in language itself. So I suppose a reader of my poetry can say nice things like you've just said, but I'm more unaware of that, perhaps, as the writer of the poems.
There is a musical element in it too, I find. Music was around you when you were small, wasn't it?
When I was about 7, my mother and my grandmother, who was Irish, went to an auction. I think they'd had a few drinks before. It was the first auction either of them had ever been to. Anyway, they came home having successfully bid for a piano. My father was very cross at this large piece of furniture. But, of course, this meant that someone had to play it. and being the eldest of five, I was packed off for piano lessons, which I think I did for about 10 years and went through all the grades at piano.
Your mother loved to hear you play there.
She did. I mean, she was quite a romantic person, my mother, so she would get me to play when she was doing the ironing. If we had an argument or I'd been naughty and she was cross with me, was able to melt her heart by playing the piano.
Would this be one of the pieces that you played?
Yes, it's a piece by Chopin, is her favourite piece, and I would come down from disgrace and begin to play this to make up.
The Etude in E Major, Opus 10, Number 3 by Chopin, played by Maurizio Pollini. It's extraordinary that that short piece, which begins so calmly and smoothly, has that kind of volcanic eruption in the middle before returning to that calm.
A bit like a poem, isn't it?
Yeah, I was just thinking something like that.
I think he thought that was the most beautiful melody he wrote and would clap when he heard people playing it.
Do you see a strong correlation between what you do and the writing of music?
Yeah, I've often thought about this. I mean, is music superior to poetry? Probably yes. It is an abstract language, if you like. In a poem, you have to name and define and shape in a way that music doesn't have to. I'm very fond of opera. Probably that's the area where I can have both. But there is a sublime reach that music can have, which poetry can't, I think. So I think poetry probably learns from music, not the other way around.
You mentioned opera, and you've chosen two Mozart operas.
Yes, I mean, I had difficulty choosing the music for your programme because I probably have done all Mozart quite happily. A few years ago, I was very lucky to work with the great theatre director, Tim Supple, who was doing an opera for Opera North, The Magic Flute, and I wrote the libretto for that. And I think I worked every day for 3 months, just with the headphones on, listening to that wonderful music and trying to find English words that could be sung. It was such a strange experience. It was like being in love, that heightened, giddy feeling that you have when you're first in love, but not being in love. It was the music of Mozart that was opening my heart in a quite extraordinary way.
What have you chosen to play from The Magic Flute?
I've chosen the moment when the lovers, Tamino and Pamina, have to go through their trial of fire and water to prove that their love is strong. But I felt, when I first heard this piece of music, and increasingly feel, that it's not so much about the lovers, it's more Mozart's passionate love of music itself. So it feels to me like an intense statement of belief and passion for music from, I think, the greatest of our composers. Oh, sublime.
Tamino Mine from Act Two of Mozart's The Magic Flute. We heard wonderful cast. Gundula Janowitz singing Pamina, Nikolai Gedda, Tamino, and the Philharmonia Orchestra, conducted by Otto Klemperer. It occurred to me while we were listening to that, Caroline Duffy, that as somebody who's also written for the theatre, you must have been fascinated by the ability of opera, and especially in Mozart, for various characters to articulate different ideas simultaneously.
Well, later I'd like to hear a piece from The Marriage of Figaro, which I think completely sums that up. But yes, I mean, I've done a little in theatre, but my brief connection with opera has been, you know, the happiest and most amazing experience I've had as a poet working in another form.
We're talking about childhood earlier, and the next piece, I think, probably has resonances for you, not only in terms of, you know, what fairy tales and your childhood, but being a mother yourself.
Yes, I suppose the main area that I've worked in outside of poetry has been with the fairy tale. I mentioned the director Tim Supple earlier, and with Tim Supple and Melly Still, whom I'm working with at the moment, I've done a lot of bringing of the fairy tale into the theatre. I loved Grimm's as a child. It would probably be my, if you like, Desert Island Disc book. And I've used fairy tale a lot in my own work. And then, of course, I'm a mother now, so since my daughter has been little, I've written new fairy tales for her. At one point, I came very close to doing the libretto of Humperdinck's Hansel and Gretel, and the piece of music we're about to hear, I did do an English version of. And this connects, if you like, my own childhood, my life as a poet, and my sense of motherhood in the beautiful prayer that Hansel and Gretel sing together in the forest.
Thank you.
It's often thought by poets, if they can write just one great poem in their life, that's enough. And I think with Humperdinck, that pretty little Christmas opera is the best thing he wrote. Interestingly, Humperdinck's sister wrote the libretto. So there's a lovely kind of family connection with that.
As I was listening, the word that came to my mind was also the title of one of your really beautiful collections, which is Rapture.
I think art at its most sublime does have that crossing, that touching, that kiss between the human and, if you like, the divine. And I think for me, the music that means most to me and that I return to most and will use at times of rapture or perhaps desolation does have a transcendent reach, which without words explains itself to me and myself to myself.
Well, we heard Elisabeth Schwarzkopf singing Gretel, Lisbeth Grüme, Hansel, and Annie Felbermayr was the Sandman. The Sandman and Prayer Scene from Act 2, Scene 2 of Hansel and Gretel by Humperdinck, the Philharmonia Orchestra, conducted by Herbert von Karajan. The next choice, Caroline Duffy, I think, is to do with the poem that you first fell in love with.
Yes, I thought I should really have something intimately connected with poetry. And The Song of Wandering Angus by W.B. Yeats is the first poem that I, as it were, swooned over, the first poem I learned by heart, the first poem I wanted to copy. I think poets begin by imitation. It's still my favourite poem from about the age of 11, I think. And I love the great Irish musician Christy Moore. I've been lucky enough to hear him perform, and he has a wonderful setting of this poem.
I went down to the hazel wood because a fire was in my head. I cut and peeled a hazel wand and hooked a berry to a thread. And when white moths were on the wing and moth-like stars were flickering out, I dropped the berry in a stream. When I had laid it on the floor, I went to blow the fire aflame. When something rustled on the floor, and someone called me by my name, it had become a glimmering girl with apple blossoms in her hair, who called me by my name and ran and faded in. I will find out where she has gone and kiss her lips and hold her hands. and walk among long dappled grass, and pluck till time and times are done, the silver apples of the moon, the golden apples of the sun.
Christy Moore with setting of Yeats's poem Song of Wandering Angus. I think Yeats actually is very settable as a poet, Caroline Duffy. Sometimes poetry that is too jewel encrusted, Shakespeare for example, sets a much bigger challenge for a composer. Do you know what I mean? That there's so much happening in such a short space of time, it's quite hard.
Yeah, I mean, I'm not generally a fan of poems being set to music. That's a very rare exception. And I think Christy Moore works very closely with many living Irish poets, so his sensibility is unique, I think. I think there is a difference between the written lyric, where the writer has a sense that they're writing for music, and the poem which is set by the composer. So I think poetry really is different from the words of a song because the poetry carries within itself its own music. So to put music on top of the music of the poem often doesn't work. I'm not really keen on my work being put to music, although I have happily written words for composers to set.
We mentioned The Marriage of Figaro earlier, and that's indeed what we come to now.
Yes, if I have one ambition in my life, it's to do a libretto for this opera. I've chosen the forgiveness scene where the Count remembers his love for the Contessa and asks for forgiveness, and she gives him the forgiveness he asks for. And I think it's the music that they might play if one died and went to heaven, really, that only Mozart was capable of writing. Beautiful boy.
It's a kind of musical version, if you like, of what Shakespeare managed to do.
Yes, I mean, I often think that Shakespeare is the language. I find it difficult to think of him as a human being. He almost is the language that one writes in, that one speaks, and Mozart is pretty close to being music itself, I think.
Music from the Marriage of Figaro, Act 4, Finale. We heard Thomas Allen singing Count Almaviva, Kirite Kanua, Countess Almaviva, and the London Philharmonic Orchestra, conducted by Sir George Sholte. In your latest collection of poems, The Bees, there's a great deal of touching writing about bereavement, but there's also a poem where you manage to mention not only the next piece we're going to hear, but the piece after that. And the poem is actually called Music. I was going to ask if after we hear the first piece, Danny Boy, you would read the poem as a connection into the Bach double concerto. Have you often written about music as a subject?
I think that's the only time I have in that particular poem. Interestingly, until you said just now, I hadn't realised that I had picked two pieces of music from that poem. That's interesting. I think, for me, music and poetry really are there for love and for death, really. Obviously, everything in between. And I wanted to examine some of my thoughts about music as an art form in the poem. And I do mention Danny Boy in that poem. I think that song is probably the first song I'm aware of knowing. I must have known it from day one of birth. It was my mother's lullaby. My father was a great pub singer, so he would be getting up and loosening his tie and belting this out. I love the jazz singer Diana Krall very much, and also the Irish band The Chieftains. They've done a fantastic version of this song, which I played at my mother's funeral.
Oh, Danny boy, the pipes are calling. From glen to glen and down the mountainside, the summer's gone and all the flowers are falling. Tis you must go and I must bide. But come ye back when summer's in the meadow, or when the valley's hushed and white with snow. Tis I'll be there in sunshine or in shadow. Oh, Danny boy. I love you so. If I am there as dead I will be. You'll come and find the place where I am loved, and you'll say, an ave for me. And I'm sure though soft you tread above, and all my bread will warm sweeter. If you will build and tell me that you love me, then I shall sleep in peace until you come to me.
Music. Do you think they cried, the children who followed the piper, when the rock closed behind them forever, or cried never, happy to dance to his tune, lost in the music? And the lame boy, pressing his ear to locked stone to carry an echo home in his head, did he weep alone, the melody gone? Tell me, who hasn't tossed a coin in a hat for the busker on blues harmonica, heartbreak in the rain, or stood in the square by the students there, cheap violins gleaming under their chins, the bark double clapped by pigeons, or smiled at the ragged choir rattling their tins? What's music the food of? Send over a beer to the bow-tied piano man to play it again. A child's hands on the keys, opening a scale like a toy of sound. And who hasn't lifted the lid to pick at a tune with a fingertip? Perfect Day, Danny Boy, Fur Elise, recalling a name or a kiss, the breath our lips shared, unsung song. When the light's gone, it's what the dying choose, the music we use at funerals, psalms listed in Roman numerals, solo soprano singing to a grave, sometimes the pipe, a harp. Do you think music hath charms? Do you think it hears and heals our hearts?
Thank you.
We heard David and Igor Oistrakh playing the Largo, the slow movement from Bach's Concerto in D minor for two violins, BWV 1043, with the Royal Philharmonic Orchestra, conducted by Sir Eugene Goossens. Before that, Caroline Duffy read music. And then before that, we heard Diana Krall singing Danny Boy with the Chieftains, arranged by Paddy Maloney. You've just compiled 60 poems to celebrate the Jubilee, and I think, in fact, it's possible to hear 20 of them read by well-known actors on the Interactive Arts website, The Space. But I thought the nicest taste we could have of the volume would be to ask you possibly to read your contribution, which is about the Thames, I think, which, of course, the Queen is going to sail down.
Absolutely. Well, the first poem in the anthology is by the Welsh poet Danny Absey, 1953. And I had, of course, to take on the task of writing 2012 for the great pageant on the Thames. The Thames, London, 2012. History as water. I lie back, remember it all. You could say I drink to recall, run softly till you end your song. I reflect. There was a whale in me, a king's daughter livid in a boat. A severed head fell from its spike, splashed. There was fire. Birds flailed in me with burning wings. Ice. A whole ox roasting where I froze, frost fur. Fog. 4 months sunless, moonless, spooked by ships. Flood. I flowed into Westminster Hall, where lawyers rode in wherries, worried. Blitz. The sky was war, I filmed it, cut. I held the Marchioness. My salmon-fed apprentices, until I choked on sewage. My foul breath shut Parliament. There was lament at every stroke of every oar, which dragged the Virgin's barge downstream. Always bells, their timed sound, some when, in my tamed tides deep. Caesar named me, I taste the drowned. A queen sails now into the sun, flotilla 1,000 proud. My dazzled surface gargling the crown.
I suppose the question I might ask you next, which is slightly provocative, is that we've talked about the music that reminded you of your mother. What do you think you might choose for your own funeral?
Well, I'd have everything that we've played in this programme, of course, all of that, but I am very drawn to humour and the subversive, so I might do something a little surprising, a little burlesque.
Thank you very much, Carol Ann Duffy, and thank you, David Rose and his orchestra, for providing us with your exit music, which you accompanied with such florid movements, The Stripper. Thank you.
Private passions. Can I put my clothes on now?
Carol Ann Duffy, the poet laureate, was talking to Michael Barclay, and next week Michael's guest will be the actress Celia Imrie. Private Passions is a classic arts production for BBC Radio 3, and the producer of today's programme was Chris Marshall.
The electric telegraph and the telephone, the electric light bulb, the typewriter, these might seem more useful, but the phonograph will become the instrument and shrine of music and poetry.
It's May 1889.
Would you consider recording a few poems on my phonograph?
My secretary deals with things of this
Come
sort.
Come on, sir, say yes.
The poet laureate Alfred Lord Tennyson stands before a newfangled phonograph machine.
The man is undoubtedly a genius.
Good Lord, I never thought of him in that way.
He takes a deep breath.
Over 600 stanzas of 4 lines each.
Couldn't you choose a few highlights?
And recites a poem. Tennyson and Edison.
The phonograph is a form of afterlife. Recorded sound as an ear on the infinite.
The next drama on 3, tonight at 8:30.
BBC Radio 3, 90 to 93 FM, on digital radio and online. Just gone 1 o'clock, time for the news from Susan Ray.
The Queen's Diamond Jubilee Flotilla is moving into its final formation before setting sail along the River Thames this afternoon. 1,000 boats and ships of all shapes and sizes, from steamboats to rowing boats, are taking part in the largest river pageant held in London for more than 300 years. The Queen will be seated on a royal barge, covered in garlands of flowers from her gardens. David Cameron has paid tribute to her, saying that she is 100% dedicated and doing an amazing job. President Assad of Syria has said he will continue to confront terrorism and that a foreign plot is trying to destroy the country. Speaking to the country's parliament in Damascus, he denied that his forces were involved in the massacre in the town of Houla last month, in which more than 100 men, women and children were killed. A British-based campaign group says 57 soldiers were killed in Syria yesterday, the highest number of casualties suffered by the military since the uprising began more than a year ago. David Cameron has defended the U-turns on tax which have been announced since the budget. He said it took courage for a government to admit that it was ploughing into a brick wall and change course. He insisted ministers still had the necessary resolve, strength and grit. Hundreds of people are occupying Tahrir Square in the Egyptian capital Cairo after protests overnight about the trial of the former president Hosni Mubarak. Demonstrators are angry that Mubarak and his interior minister were not given the death sentence for their part in the killing of protesters during last year's uprising. The American Defense Secretary Leon Panetta is visiting a former US naval base in Vietnam, a day after he announced that the bulk of the US Navy would be stationed in the Pacific. He's the most senior American official to visit Cam Ranh Bay since the end of the Vietnam War, in a sign of growing military cooperation between the two countries. And the weather, Scotland and Northern Ireland will be dry but chilly with some sunshine. It'll also feel cooler across the rest of the UK with the possibility of heavy showers. And that's the BBC News and Weather.
And so to the early music show, which is introduced by Catherine Bott.
Hello, don't turn off the radio. This is the Early Music Show and there's method in my madness. When Queen Elizabeth II came to the throne in 1952, many hopeful parallels were made with the reign of an earlier Queen Elizabeth, also an attractive young princess, serious of purpose, who hadn't been born to be queen and head of the established church, but who assumed her role with grace and intelligence when the day came. So in the 1950s, Good Queen Bess became an understandable source of interest for historians and musicians alike, including Benjamin Britten, whose opera Gloriana, actually premiered at coronation time in 1953, focuses on the Virgin Queen's relationship with the Earl of Essex. The opera was based on the 1928 book Elizabeth and Essex by Lytton Strachey, who specialised in writing about English queens. But the name Gloriana was originally coined by Edmund Spenser in his allegorical poem written to please Elizabeth, the Fairy Queen. It would be unwise to make any claim for the 1950s as a key decade in the revival of early music in this country. That had been underway for some years. But thanks to the optimism surrounding our new young queen, it was a time when more and more people started to take an interest in all things Elizabethan, like the Triumphs of Oriana, a collection of English madrigals from 1601, assembled in honour of Elizabeth I.
Long live fair Oriana.
Canzone Antiqua, singing Long Live Fair Oriana by Ellis Gibbons from The Triumphs of Oriana, that glorious early example of doing as Disraeli later recommended. Everyone likes flattery, he said, and when you come to royalty, you should lay it on with a trowel. In today's Early Music Show, I'm looking at some of the music and musicians who helped to bring medieval, Renaissance and Baroque music into the forefront of the music scene during the 1950s. We've already heard that Benjamin Britten threw himself into the past with his opera Gloriana and with some of his realisations of songs by Purcell. And it was Purcell who also provided inspiration for musicologist Walter Bergman and his friend composer Michael Tippett.
If music be the food of love, sing on, sing on, sing on, sing on till I am filled. I'm filled with joy, for then my listening soul you move, for then my listening soul you move to pleasures that can never cloy. Your eyes, your mien, your tongue declare that you are music. Eyes, your mien, your tongue declare that you are music everywhere. Pleasures invade both eye and ear, so fierce, so fierce, so fierce, so fierce the transports are. My senses feasted are, for yet a tree.